This is Chasing Wisdom, your source for conversation and serious ideas for those striving to become wiser leaders in business. Your host is Dr. Sam Serto. Sam is the Steinmetz Professor of Management in the Graduate School of Business at Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida. He also serves as a leader at Northland, a church distributed located in Central Florida. Along with leaders from various fields, our goal is to provide practical wisdom for those navigating real-world business challenges. Welcome to this conversation about how to become a wiser leader in business, Bible, and life.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Sam Serto, and you're listening to the Chasing Wisdom podcast. Here, leaders talk about business, Bible, and life to help all of us become wiser leaders. Today, our special guest is David Berkus. David is a professor of management at Oral Roberts University and holds a doctorate in strategic leadership from Regent University. He also holds a master's degree in organizational dynamics from University of Oklahoma. At Oral Roberts, David teaches courses in creativity, entrepreneurship, and organization behavior. In a very short time, David has contributed significantly to the management leadership literature, with his thoughts and ideas gaining wide attention and acclaim. He's written a book called Myths of Creativity and is a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review, covering topics like innovation, mixing business and social good, and innovative teams. His writings have also been featured in Forbes, Financial Times, Bloomberg Business Week, and CBS This Morning. In addition to his writing and teaching, David hosts a leadership podcast called Radio Free Leader. I like that name, by the way. And was recently named one of the emerging thought leaders most likely to change the future of business. David's latest book is called Under New Management. This book is a provocative work that challenges the traditional and widely accepted principles of business management and presents the argument that many of them are outdated and simply do not work. David's joining us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. David, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And thanks. I mean, you added to the bio, made me sound way cooler than I am in real life. So, I mean, on one hand, it's all downhill from here, but thank you for having me.
Terrific. Listen, I'd like to focus on your latest book, Under New Management, and maybe we could start a conversation about that book by you simply telling us sort of the theme of the book, and maybe a backstory on how the ideas developed and how you see the book in the future.
Yeah. So if I could summarize it all, I mean, we have this idea around management that started really, we don't think of management as an invention. We think it was sort of always there. And, you know, to some extent that's true. I mean, you can point to, you know, Moses and Aaron and the idea of dividing up and drawing an org chart, et cetera. But really modern management really was an invention. It was invented in the early 1900s by a guy named Frederick Taylor, right? And Frederick Taylor was the principles of scientific management guy. He had the famous stopwatch, and his job was to make factories more efficient. He reinvented the factory floor and the factory management in order to make them more efficient. But there were a lot of underlying assumptions about what that means for management that we drug with us from the factory to the office. You know, so Frederick Taylor had this assumption that labor, frontline individual contributors, were too dumb to know exactly what the right way to do work was. So management's job was to train that. Then also that they were too lazy. They would try and do as little work as they could get away with. So it was management's job to measure all of that and to incentivize all of that. And we took a lot of those assumptions with us to this current world of more people are doing knowledge work or creative work than are doing industrial work, but we're still using a lot of those assumptions. And so really what Under New Management focuses on is these are the ideas that come out of how to run a knowledge work or a creative work company. These are the experiments that a variety of different companies are taking and the social science research behind why they're such a good idea.
All right. So that in a sense, we're talking about maybe a new way to manage in a realm that represents modern society, in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And each chapter, I mean, on the surface, each chapter looks very, very different. I mean, we've got everything from how are you using email to how are you setting your salaries to how are you drawing the entire big things like how you draw the entire org chart. But the underlying assumption in all of them is the same, is that there was a shift 30 or 40, maybe even 50 years ago from industrial to knowledge work, and management is just now making that shift alongside it.
All right, terrific. I'd like to drill down into some of the chapters, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
And the one that certainly catches my attention right away is the idea of outlawing email.
Everybody loves that chapter. All right.
Everybody just started using it. Now we're going to outlaw it.
Well, yeah. So, email was an amazing invention. It was definitely not invented for the complexity that we currently use it for. And it has two big advantages over all other forms of communication, right? It's cheap and it's asynchronous, right? So what that means is we can send a lot of it and we can send it whenever we want. Unlike an office phone that we can only call them during business hours because they won't be in the office, et cetera, we can send an email whenever we want. The problem is we send too much of it and we send it whenever we want. And so a lot of companies are looking at this is not the best way to manage the flow of communication around teams, even internally. If you're just doing it even during office hours, most people default to the settings on their Outlook or their Mac Mail or whatever they use that go and check email every 5 minutes. Well, the research shows that if you're distracted, it takes 10 to 15 minutes to get back to what you were doing that was that productive deep work. So if every 5 minutes your Outlook is going off, you might spend the entire day just being in distraction, feeling productive because you're clearing out your inbox, but not actually doing any work that produces any value. So in the same way, we see it when you take your work home with you. I mean, literally everybody who has a smartphone by definition is now taking their work home with them, right? Because the smartphone mm-hmm. probably has their work email on it, and there's an expectation that they can get a hold of you whenever they need to via email, and also that you should probably reply. And that's really bad for giving people the downtime and the rest that they need in order to avoid burnout. It's really bad for family lives. It actually shows it's even bad for the manager and managee relationship to be getting those emails throughout the day. So you see a bunch of different companies that are either banning it entirely and saying, you know, we don't even do internal email because there are better ways to communicate internally as a team, or other companies are just saying, hey, we're putting limits on when we're doing email. So we'll shut the servers down at night and on the weekends, or we'll encourage people to only check it at certain times a day, or we'll encourage email free times. So between, you know, 1 and 4 in the afternoon, no one sends email. There are a bunch of different ways that we do it, but all of them are attempts to say, let's have a conversation about this tool and let's find out where we can use it effectively and where we can't.
One of the words you mentioned, which is important in people thinking about your book, you mentioned the word research. Mm-hmm. And that the book that you have come out with is not one that is a reflection necessarily on just your experiences or some type of idiosyncratic thing that someone is doing somewhere else. It's actually reflective of different kind of research in the field. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Now you're bringing out the academic in me, right? So it's definitely not a book of my experiences because my experiences are useless. Right. And to some extent, I mean, even if we had, I mean, I love reading Jack Welch's books because I love reading about his experience. But if I'm trying to learn how to lead an organization or even just lead a team and all I'm doing is reading one person's experience, that's totally useless. If I read lots of different people's experiences and I can kind of combine those, judge failures and successes and extract lessons from lots of different people, then that's effective. But, you know, that's the academic in me. We would call that research. That's exactly how a research study is done. We give 200 people the same experience and then we judge how that worked against the control group. So there are huge benefits to that idea of being more than what I call a sample size of one, which is just that experience. And so my goal was really to bring others, a diverse set of corporate experiences alongside with the academic research and pair them together in a way that shows not only is there evidence of this working right now in the workplace, there's a ton of evidence about why it works in the workplace as well.
We have in the podcasts, each podcast, a feature called Sunday to Monday. And Sunday to Monday is something that you might hear on a Sunday from the pulpit or in church or wherever. And the idea here is what might you hear that you can take through Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and the rest of the work week? So that one of the issues that pops into my mind is something from Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24, where it really talks about let's not neglect meeting together. And let's use those meetings for encouragement of one another. This, in a sense, is a theme that you're carrying forward in your Let's Outlaw Email.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, there's definitely a trend in a lot of popular literature to do away with meetings, to say that meetings are evil, they waste time because no one's being all that productive. But I actually actually have a piece in the blog side of the Harvard Business Review called "No, That Meeting Couldn't Have Been an Email," and basically talking about how much communication is lost when we're just doing it text-based and we're doing it asynchronously. Now, that said, we still do waste a lot of time in unstructured meetings and those sort of things, but that doesn't mean that doing away with meetings entirely is going to solve all of that. I do think there's a decent amount of research that says doing away with email and replacing them with face-to-face conversations. So I definitely lean that regard. Let's not neglect our meetings. And also, I mean, to the point of, if you go back to like church history, that was when a lot of culture was imbued. That was when a lot of lessons were imbued. And in organizations the same way. It's when we're meeting in face-to-face that we have the opportunity to shape our culture. And that will determine our behavior in the future far more than just emails about policy.
Let's go to another chapter.
Yeah.
I'm in the driver's seat, so I can pick the chapters I really like.
Yeah, no, go for it.
They're all good, but here we go. All right, there's one chapter called Hire as a Team.
So hiring as a team is a really interesting concept that it doesn't, on the surface, it doesn't sound all that revolutionary, but it really is that different. So most people, when they get hired into an organization, you'll have an interview or two with your manager, then maybe meet her manager, and then that's it. We make a decision whether or not to partner with you for the next 5 or 10 years to let you join our family based off meeting with 2 to 3 people in the organization. And that, I mean, there's a ton of research that supports that interviews are terrible predictors. There are things we can do that can make them slightly better predictors. But one of the biggest harms with them is that you're limiting how many people are interacting with that person. And what we know now from modern research about performance, especially in knowledge work or creative work, so much of individual performance is actually affected by the team that you're on, the resources that the company can provide you. And there are companies that spend a lot of money hiring people because of their past performance and then put them into an environment and on a team that looks nothing like the team that they were coming from that allowed them to have that performance. And their performance suffers. And so to some extent, hiring as a team is a fix for this. You're not necessarily using the team for competency interviews. You still might be using managers and HR people for that. But you really want to get a sense of team fit, because that's going to be a huge driver of whether or not this person is actually successful in the workplace, how well they work on that team, how much that team is willing to be them. So much of knowledge work is teamwork. And the team that you're going to be on should probably be the one deciding whether or not you get on in the first place.
Good point. One of the things that comes to my mind in talking about this conversation is a biblical theme that talks about know the condition of your flocks, and that knowing that condition tells you, in essence, what you need to do or what you should be doing in order to care for that that particular flock. So when you think about hiring as a team, one of the implications here is that the team needs to know itself, needs to know the condition of itself in order to move forward. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things the team should know about itself in order to move forward in hiring in a positive way?
You know, a lot of times we do a really great job now with focusing in on diversity, but sometimes we can lack that ideological diversity that we also need, that perspective diversity. The other thing that they really need is each person, I think, needs to know themselves and then contribute to an honest conversation to the flock, to the team, about their strengths and weaknesses. You know, the best teams aren't full of 6 well-rounded people. They're full of 6 people whose strengths offset weaknesses in the other people on the team. And you only get there through an honest conversation about what am I great at, what am I terrible at, and how can we each offset each other in order to be a strong team. Strong teams aren't built from well-rounded individuals. They're built from strong people whose weaknesses are offset by other people on the team's strengths.
One of the other topics you talk about is organization charts. That's one of my favorite topics and near and dear to my heart. You talk about doing them in pencil.
Yeah. So I love org charts, but I love doing them in pencil, and I'll get to what I mean in a second. The first org chart ever invented was invented by, or that we know of invented, was invented by a guy named Daniel McCollum, and he was drawing a reporting relationship in an org chart for the railroad industry. You know, almost by definition, the railroad industry is an industry that very rarely changes. You know, you spend all the money to lay down the track, that is the track. You're going to make modifications to it, and you're going to add on to it, but you're probably not going to jumble the entire thing. Most companies, the pace of change happens much quicker than does the railroad industry in the 1800s when Daniel McCollum was working. And so org charts are wonderful tools for reporting relationships, for managing the flow of communication. The challenge is I don't think we rewrite them as often. We tend to write our org charts around products and functional divisions, and that's great. But when changes in the market happen, changes in the environment happen, you see a lot of challenges in resiliency in that. You know, I come from the world of pharmaceuticals. Before I went back to grad school, I worked as a drug rep, and that was the ultimate industry of we wrote out the org chart by what product you sold, and when that product got discontinued, we'd lay off 500 people. And then when we had a new product to roll out, we'd have to suddenly run and hire 500 people, right? And instead of thinking about, okay, what are the projects we're engaged in over the next 18 to 24 months? And then how do we build teams around that and those projects instead of products? And then we look again, you know, 6 to 12 months down the road, what are the new projects that are coming? So it's not the idea that we do away with an org chart entirely, but that we're willing to keep erasing it and redrawing it as if it were written in pencil, instead of saying, this is the way it is, it's going to be the way it always is.
Because as things change, you fight a new war. And as you fight a new war, you need to redesign the way people are interacting with one another. And speaking of starting a war or fighting a war, Colin Powell has a great quote that fits perfectly with this conversation, David. He says that organization charts and fancy titles count for next to nothing. And he's talking about the idea of things aren't repetitive all the time. There's newness that comes into the world, and as newness comes, reorganization needs to come.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the other to his point too. The other I didn't get into this in Under New Management, but because I it's more anecdotal, experiential evidence, right? Which is code for I see this, but I have no data. Is the idea that when there is an org chart, people instinctively want to climb up it. And I'm far more concerned with working with people who want to do the job they're doing now than people that want to chase a title. You know, I mean, I love that the name of the podcast is Chasing Wisdom. I want to work with those people. I don't want to work with the people who want to chase a title. And when you have a rigid org chart that's drawn out, that gives somebody an invitation to climb up it, you end up with people who are chasing titles.
Okay, well said. We end each podcast with what's called a pearl of wisdom. So this is your shot, David, right here. What do you recommend for a thought or idea that somebody might carry forward in order to become a wiser leader in an organization?
Yeah. Great leaders don't innovate the product. They innovate the factory. This was actually one that was given to me. I was interviewing Dane Atkinson, who is the head of a company called Sumoff. And it's this idea that when you're, you know, when most people start a business or start a ministry, et cetera, there's one person and they're focused on what is the product or service we deliver, what is the ministry that we provide, et cetera. And as you add people to it, it can be tempting to think you're still in the driver's seat about products and services and those sort of things. But once you add a lot of people to the organization or the movement, your role as the leader switches to making sure that you're reinventing the factory, the office, the, you know, factory is a metaphor for the organization, making sure that you're focused on innovation there so that your people are free to do their best work, to innovate the products, innovate the services, provide better service, et cetera. So the great leaders stop focusing in on those individual projects and start focusing in on the whole organization so that they're reinventing it, innovating it, and giving their people the ability to innovate everything else.
The point that you make, and I think should be underscored, is the use of the word factory. And when a lot of us think of factory, they think of nuts and bolts and things being assembled that way. And that's not at all what you're meaning.
No, not at all. And you know, I use the word factory in the book because I started the book with the Frederick Taylor discussion. And he's a great example of someone who literally innovated the factory and brought in a next wave of the Industrial Revolution. I think the same thing happens here when you look at companies now in 2016 that are creating innovative products or services. When you look at ministries that are doing amazing things, churches and universities, everything that are doing the amazing things, they're led by people who are focused on making sure the rest of the people in the organization have what they need to do that great work. They're themselves not trying to do it all. They're focused on making sure the organization stays innovated so people can keep doing their best work.
Charles Kettering underscores this. Kettering was really the head of research for over 30 years at General Motors. One of his widely accepted statements is that your system is perfectly designed to give you the results you're getting. If you want different results, you have to change the system. So you could use factory in the place of system here and say that if you want some different result, you need to change the factory somehow.
No, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well said. Well said. Unfortunately, our time is up with David. David, thank you so much for being here. You can get in touch with David at his website, davidberkus.com. To all of you listeners, thank you for tuning in on Wisdom Wednesday. You can keep in touch with me on Facebook at chasing.wisdom or my website, chasewisdom.com. Meanwhile, remember to keep chasing. God bless.
You've been listening to Chasing Wisdom with host Dr. Sam Serto. We would love to hear from you regarding this podcast. You can reach us at northlandchurch.net/chasingwisdom. We will be here each Wednesday with a fresh look at being a wiser leader in business, Bible, and life. Want to reach out to Dr. Serto? Email him at sserto@rollins.edu.